Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. To my loyal listeners, I owe you an apology. For over 10 years, we've produced a weekly podcast, which you have come to rely upon. Then came a series of unfortunate events. In 2016, the radio station I'd relied upon for 18 years went dark as a result of changes in the financial dynamics of public radio. Also in 2016, I was robbed of over a year's income by an unscrupulous Internet Medical Record Corporation, and we've been struggling to continue my medical practice in the wake of that. Remember, I'm a full-time practicing MD, and I podcast on the side. It's been a lot of work to convert to a new medical record system, to transfer the data, and make sure that my patients' medical records have been securely maintained. Our mission, to provide news you can use and science education, has never faltered, and we continue to do hours of live call-in every month, with a little help from my friends in Santa Cruz who have other radio programs. But getting the feed out to you has suffered. And for that, Charlie and I apologize. We hope that we've gotten over the hump and will be able to return to a regular podcast feed soon. Thank you for your patience and support. Here's a show where I appeared with a little help from my friend John Sandich, on his program, Talk About, on KZSC, Santa Cruz, California, in March 2017.
This is KZSC, Santa Cruz. I'm your host, John Sandage. Our guest tonight, as she is once a month, is Dr. Dawn Motyka. Okay, you want to take this call?
Yeah, let's take it.
Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Dawn.
Hi. I wanted to bring up the topic you talked about last time or a few with post-traumatic stress
sure.
And cannabinol deficiency?
Well, okay, cannabinol deficiency, I think, is maybe a made-up term right now. I don't think we would call that.
Do you think that the immune system actually consumes cannabinol because of stress?
I think that cannabinol is an important neurotransmitter, and that we know that there are receptors for that as well as opiates on the immune cells. I don't think that you can jump from there to saying that you have a cannabinol deficiency. That's pushing it.
It's accepted in Israel as a syndrome now, a treatable syndrome. So I'm just curious. Oh, but also, it plugs into sleep deprivation. A friend of mine explained to me that sleep is what's behind post-traumatic stress and a lot of these other symptoms. Is this chronic sleep deprivation in our society? Because we overconsume everything, information, food, light evidently has turned off our melatonin, so mm-hmm. we can't sleep.
Yes.
So if the sleep is behind it, maybe why does cannabinol work so well with sleep deprivation to, you know, put you back in alignment?
Okay. It's a very unclear question, and so
can I be clear?
Let's see if we can break it down. So your question is about whether or not you can use cannabinol to treat sleepiness or sleep deprivation.
Yeah.
Obviously, because it's a sedative and it has calming properties and people traditionally have used it for insomnia, the answer to that would be yes. Now, when you bring in the sleep deprivation as being the cause of post-traumatic stress disorder, I have to disagree with you very strongly. That's not the current understanding, and it's been studied fairly thoroughly. And what we understand it is a case of a set of synapses that form during a traumatic event or series of events that cause benign environmental cues that resemble the cues that were present at the time of the traumatic event to set off a fight-or-flight reaction. So eventually what you have are people who are triggering into fight-or-flight over and over again from via association. And the neurotransmitters that are primarily involved in this are going to be your norepinephrine and your cortisol. So the cannabinoids, to the extent that they play any kind of role in the genesis of PTSD, are probably acting by their very nature as a braking agent on the events. But yes, John.
I just wish you would explain the word cannabinoid, because a lot of people listening probably aren't familiar with that.
Okay. Well, okay, cannabis sativa and cannabis indica are the Latin names for marijuana. So when we began doing research in this world, we were like, okay, well, why does marijuana work? There must be a receptor for these chemical compounds. THC had been identified amongst others. CBD is another one that's more recently hit the news. But both of these are in a category of drugs called cannabinoids, named after the Latin name for the plant from which they are derived.
Okay. All right. So, caller?
Yes. So my question was, if cannabinoids must have some effect on the system to alleviate some of the symptoms of long-term sleep deprivation, some of which are mimicked by post-traumatic stress, inflammation. If you had a developmental trauma, like when you were a kid and you were asleep, was disrupted all the time by your parents, that's going to carry over as a post-traumatic stress symptom.
I think that, I'm going to sound like I'm being picky here, but chronic stress in childhood is a different animal than the sort of war-related PTSD that I think fits the ISD. I think we're up to the DSM-5 at this point. So the psychiatric literature and the way we define these things is defined fairly strictly for a reason, because if you try to study things and you don't define them carefully, you don't know why people got better or why they didn't get better. What happens in childhood when you're subjected to trauma, like let's say child abuse or your father sneaks into the bedroom and does things to you, is that you become hypervigilant, which is a shared symptom with PTSD, but your neural circuitry grows and develops quite differently from an adult who has PTSD. A couple of things about PTSD that are important to understand. One of which is there's a genetic predisposition to develop it. That is, you have to have the right circumstances for it to happen, but there's definitely some genes that make you more vulnerable to it. The second thing is that you can virtually guarantee that you're going to prevent PTSD if you give people beta blockers immediately after the traumatic event. So if you're in Iraq and there's an IED and you're blown clear of the Humvee, and you were traumatized by the event, if they start giving you beta blockers right away, the chances that you'll develop PTSD, whether you have the gene or not, are very low. And this has been tested in civilian populations who are in a horrific accident or something like that. So it's a different circumstance. And I think what we have to say about it is that at this point, it's complicated, and what I would like to see is more research funding in the cannabinoids, and I think they're a very, very promising drug group. Our problem right now is the same problem we have with herbs in general, which is consistency of dosing, and we don't standardize to a certain percentage, and we need to get the dosing right, and we need to understand that better. I think we have another caller.
We do, and you are on the air with said person.
Hey, how are you guys doing? Thank you for doing this. I am trying to figure out the best route to combat or get some advice on digestive issues. And I was curious if the doctor could perhaps point me in the right direction for that.
Well, give me some more information about what sort of digestive issues we're talking about.
I've had liver issues I've been on malaria pills 4 or 5 times. And on a surf trip to Panama 18, 19 years ago, I inadvertently ingested either a pesticide or an insecticide while surfing.
Uh-oh.
And so when I got back to the States, my digestive system was completely whacked, and I was seeing Dr. Carl Merritt, who did wonderful work with me. And through various tests and whatnot, it was determined that I had ingested this either pesticide or an insecticide. And so we did some detox, and I got better for the most part. But I have had low-level issues. I have gas, flatulence. Sometimes I digest, if I eat bad, like if I eat macaroni and cheese and things like that, my digestion is actually better than if I eat kale and, you know, mm-hmm. fish and quinoa and things of that nature.
When you say your digestion is better, are we referring to like your BMs, your abdominal pain, your bloating, or all of the above?
I guess a bowel movement specifically.
Okay. So you likely had damage to the mucosal surface from this pesticide, and you may have inadequate digestion. In other words, the first place I would go with a clue like that when I eat starch and starchy stuff that's basically highly processed foods, that I digest it better, may mean that that's because you don't have enough stomach acid or enough pancreatic enzymes or enough bile coming out of a damaged upper GI tract to do the processing yourself. Your teeth are okay, right? And you chew your food, because that's mm-hmm. That's also a factor. But so that's one. That's a strong possibility. That's one of the first places I would go. And you might be able to buy a few supplements at the health food store and test that hypothesis with just hydrochloric acid pills, which it's usually called betaine hydrochloride, and you can buy it at the health food store, usually 500 or 600 milligram capsules, and you take, 4 or 5 of those with your meals and pick up some digestive enzymes. The best ones are animal derived, but you just go for the highest strength you can, and on that one they have different units, so you end up having to go online and look up unit conversions to figure out which product is strong. But our benchmark is something called Creon 24, and you can look that up online. And Creon 24, when I'm treating digestive issues, I'm giving 3 capsules of that at least as a starting.
So that's an animal enzyme?
That's an animal. Oh, yeah, forget it. That's an animal enzyme. You're an animal. You're probably sure. Eating meat. The plants, yep. The plant enzymes they're good for other things. I don't use them for pancreatic insufficiency. I use actual pancreatin, it's called, for pancreatic insufficiency. It works way better. So you could see whether or not that improved things for you, and that's not requiring you to go to a doctor. The problem, you're going to need a naturopath or a functional medicine doctor. Like myself, I'm over on Mission Street. You can look me up. You can go to my website, Ask Dr. Dawn, and you can link to my practice website from there. And I'd be a good place to start. There are a number of other functional medicine doctors in town. You can also go to the Institute for Functional Medicine and look at their find a practitioner. But that's a big piece of what I do. One of the reasons I'm a bit of a renegade in terms of general medicine is because I like to go to the, I don't just say, here, take this anti-gas pill. It's more like, well, why do you have this gas? Coming back around to that, you may have messed up your gut flora and never have gotten it really back. I'm wondering, over the years, have you done courses of things like oregano oil and Powdarco and probiotics? There's plenty of stuff on the web talking about that. Have you done any sorts of gut reboots like that?
With Dr. Carl Merritt, I remember taking oregano oil mm-hmm. and currently taking a probiotic that has, I think it's SOS, which is supposedly a prebiotic.
Right. I'm not sure what SOS stands for, but prebiotics are indigestible starches that are bacteria food, bacteria chow, if you will. So, that sounds like a reasonable start. I can't speak to your dosing on these things, right. Obviously, but I would start with that, and then if you're not what I mentioned earlier, and then if you're not getting anywhere, you probably need someone to do some advanced testing. That would include looking at a genetic fingerprint of what's growing in your bowel, and maybe checking you for food sensitivities. There's something called an elimination diet. You can find that online. and people will eliminate the big antigenic foods that have all, that have also become highly industrialized, which are wheat, corn, dairy, soy. Or we generally take people off oranges, shellfish, and I forget what the last one is. That's seven. So those are the big antigenic foods. And then, you know, we ask people not to take coffee if they're having diarrhea or cramping because it's a bowel stimulant, and chocolate for the same reason. And so people get very mad at me when I tell them no coffee, no chocolate, no bread. But but if I can get them to, you know, commit to 10 days, usually if those are driving your GI problems, a time of as short as 10 days for gut symptoms, you'll start to notice some improvements. So you could try the whole combination of things, or you could just do the digestive assist. And if that doesn't get you anywhere, try taking out the foods that we know to be triggers and see what you get.
All right. Thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Excuse me
a moment. What we want to do is give everybody a chance. So we'll give you one more question here. Okay?
You're back on.
Okay. It was back from the in the beginning of the conversation. You had mentioned hydrochloric acid. Was that right?
Yeah, it's called betaine hydrochloride. That's B as in boy, E-T-A-I-N-E, and then hydrochloride, like hydrochloric acid.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's sold as a powder in capsules. It melts in your stomach. It essentially pinch hits if your body isn't making enough hydrochloric acid, which is super common after a gut injury. And that pesticide may have actually injured the mucosal cells that produce acid. And we all sometimes make less acid as we get older anyway. But it sounds like you had an event that made you sick. So, I'm really sorry that happened to you. Surfing is kind of...
I had fun surfing, a fun time, but price to pay sometimes.
Well,
thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
I hope that was helpful for you. Bye.
And I wanted to just look at that a little bit further, because when you say I'm doing that right now with dairies, because I was having that same flatulence and swelling or
right,
and I found that it's the dairy, because I didn't do all seven of them. I just started out with dairy. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is, can you ever go back to dairy, or once you find out that's it, that's just it? Huh?
Well, generally, that's it. And what you have to do is take extra dairy digesting enzymes ahead of time. And sometimes you can have small amounts of dairy if you do that.
Oh, okay, cool. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. One of my favorite quotes is by Louis Pasteur, and he said, I'll translate from the French, chance favors the prepared mind. So... scientists are like that. They pay attention to phenomena, and sometimes that leads to real breakthroughs. So at a middle hospital near Heathrow Airport, somebody noticed that they were getting, when they got people who were wandering around the airport in a psychotic break and manic, they had almost all traveled from the West, from South America, from the United States, from Canada. And when they got people who were depressed, a disproportionate amount of them had come from the East. Now, these were obviously people who were unstable psychologically, and it didn't take much to push them over. But what they found was this interesting correlation. And it's led to a new type of psychiatric therapy called molecular clock chronobiology. It's been established that if you take a person who is clinically depressed and you sleep deprive them for just a couple of days, that sleep deprivation will actually cause them to improve dramatically with their depression. In other words, just a few days of minimal sleep, staying up, keeping them up all night, and the depressed patients reset internally and improve dramatically. And it takes the best of our drugs 2 weeks to achieve similar results. So it's quite interesting, quite dramatic, and it's bringing up a new type of therapy in psychiatry that I find very exciting.
Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. This depression test, does that mean I could... just blast my stereo when my neighbor looks depressed at night.
Well, it's been done in a more formalized setting, but basically the therapeutic protocol involves full overnight sleep deprivation for 1 or 2 days, a lot of bright light in the morning, and in some of the people, they also used a little bit of melatonin in the evening, about 2 or 3 hours before bedtime, but that was just a small branch, and the big dramatic effects were clearly from the sleep deprivation, and they got about 40, I believe it was somewhere, it was 60% of people improved within 48 hours, which is, you know, really, really astonishing. Now, it's a preliminary study. You've got to worry about placebo effect because you can't exactly do a double-blind study if you're keeping the person up all night. They're going to know that they're in the experimental group and not the placebo group.
Shall we take this call?
Yes, let's take this call.
Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don. Good evening.
Oh, hey. We miss Dr. Don on Saturdays, and we appreciate that she's on with Sleepy John with you there tonight.
Well, thank you.
I'm Glenn from PG. I'm having number two toe on 1 foot, number two and three on another foot. They're starting to pull back, kind of like a with a trigger toe, but it's I don't know what I can do without doing surgery. Is there acupuncture? What can I do? It's hard to get on your knees and put the pressure because your toe's trying to go forward, you know?
I think what you're referring to is hammer toe. So I want you to go, you know, go Google hammer toe image, and you'll get some pictures. And if any of them look familiar, then I have pulled a radio diagnosis out of my out of my hat all over again. And I always love when people call with a rash.
Yeah. What's causing this rash?
Yes, exactly. But anyway, back to your toes. This is a degenerative process. The tendons are tightening up, and you're getting what's called a contracture. A lot of aggressive manipulation will help. You might be fueling it by banging the toes into the tip of your shoes. Typically, for most people, the second toe is a little bit is the longest, and so that's usually the first one to curl up. The big toe doesn't do this. Because you use it for balance. So you're always using the big toe and pushing it down against the ground to help you keep your balance. But you don't do that with your other toes particularly, and so they don't get any push-down time. And as a result, they tend to draw up and contract like this. In terms of what you could do about it, it is sort of a progressive process, and it sounds like yours might be fairly advanced. Changing your footwear, wearing a boxy toed shoe, and using toe separators if the toes are starting to cross over might be helpful. I can give you the name of a couple of good podiatrists, but if you're down in Pacific Grove, it'd be quite a schlep up here, and the only people I know enough well enough to want to recommend would be up here in Santa Cruz. But they're mostly if they're bothersome, you have to either find a workaround or you have to do surgery. I've never attempted, nor do I think I would attempt, to treat hammer toe with acupuncture because it's a dense structural problem, and with dense structural problems, mostly you can't really unstructure them. There are some exceptions, but that tends to be things like tumors and benign tumors and stuff of the uterus that doesn't work particularly well for hammer toe that I know of. Sorry.
Right. Well, that's fine. No, I'm in Santa Cruz a couple days a week, but I had these bunions on both feet, and they weren't really that much of a problem, but these two hammer toes have just occurred recently. In fact, one of them occurred after I got some injections of alcohol for a Morton's neuroma that I was having.
Oh.
And I don't really know, other than well, my toes, none of them go the direction they're supposed to go, that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
Well, what is that
Morton's neuroma?
Yeah, Morton's neuroma.
Well, when people's, you know how bones are shaped, right? They've got their narrow shaft and they've got a kind of bulbous thing on either end. Well, when you've got your foot, you've got five of those bulbous things lined up against each other and the poor little nerve has to get out between those bones. And if the nerve gets pinched, it develops a callus. And so Morton's neuroma is essentially a callus on a nerve that's being pushed on by bones, which makes it bigger, which is not good because it was already in a tight space. So it's kind of like it's sort of like a callus that you get on the bottom of your foot that makes your shoe fit less well, so you get more callus, and off we go, loop-de-loop.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, caller, you're back.
Yeah, no, that's right. I thought it was a bone bruise, but it was at Morton's neuroma.
Yeah.
And I had five injections of alcohol, which cost $1,000, and it solved that problem. And then months later, now my longest toe is not my longest toe on either foot.
Yeah. So, I wish you'd called about the Morton's neuroma, because that I could treat with acupuncture.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to... sometimes. I mean, I'm not, you know, the best acupuncturist on the planet, and I have my treatment failures. But that is the painful Morton's neuroma is one that I've had surprisingly good success with. Now, back to your situation, the injections could conceivably, and I'm not saying they did, but you are putting an irritant near the tendons, and potentially the tendon might have gotten irritated and decided to start contracting as a result of the irritation. No way to prove it. And, you know, one's natural tendency is to look for cause and effect when you have two events that occur in proximity. So, or water under the bridge, either way. And at this point, I think what I said about get some clogs, like the old Swedish clogs, you know what I'm talking about? And when you're doing stuff where you're kneeling or getting down, working around the house and stuff, if your feet are in clogs, you won't be pushing. When you kneel, you know, and get, you won't be pushing on the neuromas because the stiffness of the clog will basically protect them. You'll have a roof over them. And you might find it a lot easier. You have to stretch your ankle a little bit, but it might work for you. Give it a shot.
I appreciate it. And what was the podiatrist in Santa Cruz that you would recommend?
I like Jason Novick, and I like Alvy Hooray.
Thank you for your help.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
Yeah, I recently... First, thanks for the show. And I recently had a root canal, and I'm going to have, like, the three or four stages, I guess. I'm new to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just wondering about what's the best material for long-term for a crown? I've never had a crown. They want to do gold. Is that good to have in your mouth for long-term, or is there a preferable
gold
material?
Gold is really inert, and it's really not just gold that you've got in there, of course, because gold is also very soft. So it's an alloy of gold. And the silver crowns and the gold crowns pretty much have the same strength. The porcelain crowns, which is usually, there's a metal core, but then there's porcelain over it. Those are white. And they're more cosmetically useful. But if you put those on the back teeth and you've got a strong jaw, you'll chip them and need to replace them. Now, root canals are something that I'm kind of against. And so there's a problem with root canals in that you leave behind dead meat. You can't get the canals, the roots, the endodontal ligament. You can't get that whole thing out. They get in there with a rasp and they try to remove as much of the infected tissue as they can, but they always leave some. And of course, the reason you're getting the root canal is usually because it's infected. If the tooth is dead and they're trying to save it, you might be better off just removing the tooth. And I know that's kind of radical, and it depends on where the tooth is. So
I already did it, so it's kind of too late. I know, I wasn't sure. I mean, it was kind of, I haven't been to the dentist in a long time, and I didn't go until I was desperate enough in pain for about a month.
Right.
But I just couldn't function anymore. You know, it was kind of like that.
Yeah, and that's because...
I've never had one. Yeah. I'll do it once and experience it. Mm-hmm. So I've kind of already had it done. So now it's just, it's in its
I have to go back and
get a crown.
They'll finish it, and then the next step, crown.
Yeah. Right. Well, as you said, it's done. It's not actually done. I mean, I'm not going to tell you to get the tooth pulled because I just don't know your clinical situation. Mm-hmm. I've been reading stuff about root canals. I have a dear friend, Mary Ellen Chalmers. You can read her. You can listen to her interview, actually, in the archives at Ask Dr. Don. And we touch on root canals and implants in that interview. And that was one of the things that I found really persuasive, because this is a smart and science-driven woman who knows her stuff. And, of course, it all depends on where you started out, right? If you have if you're in pain and you've got a badly infected tooth, you sort of have to address it. So I'm not going to try to second-guess the situation. If it's a back tooth, go ahead and get a metal crown. If it's a front tooth, or you don't put a lot of pressure on your teeth, a porcelain crown is more cosmetically attractive and what I recommend.
Yeah, it's a back tooth, I guess in the future. I am curious to know more about.
There'll be more.
What's the option if you're in pain like that? And desperation. And
well, if you get to the point,
canal,
yeah.
What
if,
do you do?
Well, it's called the Rock. Let me introduce you to Mr. Rock and Mr. Hard Place. And you know that's why I'm not second guessing you, because we don't have a lot of great solutions. In a perfect world, everyone would have dental care that allowed them to avoid getting so infected that they needed to sacrifice the root. So we'd take better care of our teeth, and we'd have the opportunity to take better care of our tooth, and root canals would be rare. That is one of the things that frustrates me. Actually, I was listening to Rush Limbaugh the other day. If I'm between phone calls when I'm driving somewhere, it's a great one to pop in on, because it just makes me laugh. And
well, I've ruined so many dashboards pounding on them that I don't listen anymore.
Oh, no. Well, I can understand that. But you have to take the proper attitude.
I heard
somebody said, you know, I just want to say something good about Obamacare. You know, I got my teeth worked on, and I got my back taken care of, and I know and of course, you can imagine the kind of reception he got, which was, well, you're an idiot, and you were the exception, click. But
he
wasn't the exception. And I just, you know, look at this incredible tug of war we've got here. But I'm sorry, to politicize your question.
I've had dental through work, even though it's not, I never used it. I don't go, and I do good self-care, and I'm in my 60s, and I've never had a root canal. You know, I'm at this point now, and I think the option I thought going in, well, I'll either do a root canal or pull the tooth. I figured mm-hmm. that was kind of it for me. I mean, what else could I,
you know? And
it's a tooth, you know, the first dentist I went to said, you know, take antibiotics, it's infected. And then when they sent me to the other guy, because he didn't want to do, I can't remember now, the other endodontist, and they were all very nice,
mm-hmm.
and they're doing the best they can with what they know. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm not interested. But he said, no, it's not infected. So I stopped taking the antibiotics because I don't usually do those things.
Mm-hmm.
But so it was a little funny. The whole thing's been just a strange journey, and you know.
Yeah, I know, and I think we. I'll just put it out there. I don't trust the American Dental Association. What's the cigarette company that was Philip Morris? They're like Philip Morris. They're like Exxon or Philip Morris. They stonewalled on the science for so many years on the metal fillings, and you know we had data.
Oh, yeah.
And we had data, and they just, this is inorganic, and it doesn't. And finally, you know, we've got so much overwhelming evidence that very carefully they've just stopped doing metal fillings. I mean, sometime over the last 5 years, they've just gone poof, and they don't do them anymore. No admission of guilt, no retraction. They just aren't available. And so anything they say about root canals, I'm like, yeah, show me your data. I'm seeing this other data, and it's not looking good. And I know you stonewalled last time, so I don't know what to tell you, dude. It sounds like the die is already cast. You can always, yes, at this point, monitor your inflammatory markers, which would be your high sensitivity C-reactive protein. It's been, if you had an infected tooth, it'll be high for a while. It should come down. If it stays above 3, then you need to rethink the extraction, would be my comment. It's like, okay, there's low-grade infection and it didn't get stopped. And this might be a circumstance where I would recommend antibiotics for a while after the root canal to try and kill off as much of the bacteria as possible.
But see, that endodontist said it wasn't infected. That's what I...
So what have you got to lose? You can take the antibiotics and take a ton of probiotics and probably get by, but this might be a moment to just kind of... You were having a lot of pain. And
well, I was. Not now. I mean...
Did the pain get better when you started the antibiotics?
No, the pain got better right after he did the root canal.
Well, duh, because he killed... Yeah, he amputated the nerve.
He went in there and just killed the tooth.
He did. He amputated the nerve. That's what a root canal is.
Sure, I figured that, and I was desperate.
It sounds so much nicer when you say root canal.
I always say... I like to call a spade a spade. But here's a scoop. May your roots be straight, my friend. Because if your roots are straight, then the little rasp was able to get all the way down there and clean out all the crap. And if your roots are curvy, well, that's why I want you to check that high sensitivity C-reactive protein over time and make sure that reverts into the normal range, okay?
All right. Thanks for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. All right. What you got there, Don?
Well, I got an interesting study about low-level arsenic exposure in diabetes. And I wanted to throw this one out because arsenic is in the water supply down in South County. Arsenic is present in drinking water naturally. And the levels that the FDA considers safe are 10 micrograms per liter, which is a small dose as heavy metals go and probably safe. The problem is recent data is showing a strong correlation between much lower levels of arsenic ingestion and diabetes. And so people who have a level of who are drinking arsenic in their drinking water and we're picking it up by looking in their urine. So it's either coming from their drinking water or their rice consumption. In this study, that's not differentiated. But these individuals who had the highest quartile of arsenic in their urine, still below the toxic level where we would do anything about it, had a 3.5 greater risk of diabetes developing. And that's 350%. That's the sort of risk ratio that gets people up and noticing. And when you look all the way back to the 1950s, there have been reports of diabetes from high-dose arsenic. But this is the first to look at normal population exposures and differentiate that, yes, there's a diabetes risk here. This is type 2 diabetes from having arsenic present. So what I'm putting out there is if you're on a well, please get your well tested for arsenic. And that's every year, and it's not one of it. It's just a little bit extra on your water testing, and you really want to be careful about eating large quantities of rice because every patient I've tested for heavy metals who's a big rice eater has come up high for arsenic, and it's become kind of. I'm like, oh, you eat a lot of rice, and they're like, yeah, I eat a lot of rice. I'm Asian. What do you expect? You know.
Well, I do too, and that's making me think. How much is a lot?
Yeah, well...
I mean, I usually have it for breakfast.
Here's what you want to do. You tend to use the same brand.
Yeah, well, I use brown Brusami rice that's bulk.
Right.
So it's not a brand thing. It's just in a big...
Okay, eat a lot of it, and then go get your urine tested for heavy metals. You can get that from your regular doctor.
Okay.
Okay, there we have a caller.
Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Don.
Hi, Dr. Don. I am wondering if you have had any experience with vertebroplasty or kyphoplasty, either with your patients
I have indeed. Actually, I'll tell you an anecdote. Very recently, a patient of mine sat down hard, and she developed a vertebral fracture. and underwent a balloon kyphoplasty. So I'm very up on the technology, as it happens. I think it's ready for prime time. 5 years ago, I would have had a different answer. I had several people then who did not do well. I think that and I'm not really sure what the difference in technique was, but the latest technology they're using, they have a balloon that they put in there, and then they fill the balloon with the methacrylate. And so I think it's because this is methacrylate super glue, basically. It's a gooey super glue. And you fill up the balloon with it, and it lifts the vertebrae. And I think what's happened is that they've gotten better at the placement. And of course, it's an N of one, as we say in science. But this has become more and more common as a treatment. And it doesn't have to be done as an open procedure anymore. It can be done in the radiology, in the interventional radiology suite, so that there's just a tiny little hole over the broken vertebrae. And I think that's the difference, is that this endoscopic or way less invasive procedure, you avoid cutting through all that tissue to get down to the vertebrae. And I think that's the big difference, at least clinically in this case. She still had pain for a few days, but the pain was drastically reduced, and she's doing very well. So,
can I ask how old she was?
97.
Oh, 97. That's so awesome. Okay,
yeah, there's no way that we would have gone near her with a scalpel.
This is awesome.
Yeah, so I'm feeling good about that particular procedure.
Do you know how much compression she had, like 70% loss or greater, or was it less than?
It was pretty significant. I think it was in that ballpark.
Yeah, that age, yeah. This is very encouraging. Thank you. I'm looking into this for my 95-year-old father. So, so interventional radiology. So I guess my next and last question would be, how could I pursue finding the right person to do the procedure? He's not in Santa Cruz. He's down in San Diego County.
All right. Well, you need a place that you need somebody who's done 50 of them.
Okay.
This has been studied a lot. If you've done something 50 times and you do it at least once a week, you're good at it, and you stay good at it. And this is, you know, eye-hand coordination. I'm sure you have.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have skills that you had to develop over time, whether it's tennis or embroidery or playing a musical instrument. And you know that if you don't practice it, you get clumsier. And
exactly.
I play the flute. And there's some things like making a sound and supporting the air that you don't forget. That's the riding the bicycle piece. But as far as the ability to play really rapid Bach fugues, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, thanks for your call. Appreciate hearing from you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Don. Okay.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, you don't want a clumsy doctor.
No. You want a doctor with well-developed and well-preserved eye-hand coordination.
Yes.
So I've got one for you about rosacea, which is a common problem where you get flushing and broken blood vessels on your cheek and sometimes little pimples. And I just read about this product, and I'm definitely interested in using it. It's a cream consisting of honey, 90% honey, and 10% glycerin. And that's something that can be made up. This has to be raw, unpasteurized honey. And apparently they used something called New Zealand Kanuka honey, and I have no idea whether it is like the Manuka that you can get around here.
Very similar. I'm actually familiar with that.
Oh, well, wonderful. Yes. See, what a great thing that you know that.
Yeah, so but I think it's only available there because I've had some products that were to put on your skin for abrasions and things that had that in it.
Well, they had people. It was a randomized study, 8 weeks. The dermatologist didn't know what was going on either, and they used a topical honey, like I said, 10% glycerin, and what they saw was a substantial improvement in the honey group. They had a 13% of the honey group resolved versus 3% of the controls resolving. 34% improvement in the honey group, which is literally half, twice what the 17% of controls got for their rosacea flares. So this does just as well as both of the prescription drugs, azelaic acid and metronidazole, that are marketed for honey. I mean, that are marketed for rosacea. So it looks to me like that might be something to try that's non-pharmaceutical and doesn't mess up your microbiome.
So for those of us who are not really familiar, I've seen that red. And what is causing that? And is it hereditary, or what makes that happen?
It's not hereditary. It's aggravated by a whole lot of things: alcohol, coffee, heat, emotion. So it tends to flare when those factors are present. The actual cause is unknown or unproven. In functional medicine circles, it's felt to be a food sensitivity reaction. And we will generally put people on, dum-ba-da-dum, an elimination diet. For skin, you need longer. I said 10 days for the gut to the previous caller. For skin, you need 6 weeks. And you won't see full resolution at the 6 weeks marks, but I see usually substantial improvement if I can get somebody to eliminate wheat, corn, soy. The trouble with that is that they load corn and soy products into just about everything from salad dressing to breakfast cereal, you know, and so it's very difficult to avoid unless you do all your own cooking. And that's what makes this so difficult, is that our food has been so adulterated with these products that we're confronted with very large amounts of them over time. And eventually we become immunized to them. It's as if you developed antibodies to a vaccine, except you're developing antibodies to dietary components. And if you are susceptible, and that's where the genetics come in, it'll manifest as rosacea. It could manifest as arthritis. It could manifest as GI upset. Manifest as sinus congestion, for that matter.
Wow, that's a lot of things.
Headaches. Let's see, what else? Lots of things that are interstitial cystitis, which is a burning in the urethra that makes you feel like you've got a constant bladder infection. So all of these things can be the result of food sensitivities. And once you accept that premise and you start treating them and you start seeing the kinds of clinical success that I see by doing that, you know, there's no going back, because it's just like demonstrably true.
So let me ask you a question here. If you watch like cable news, you'll find that probably 60%, 70% of the advertisements are for prescribed medicines for a huge variety of things. Most of them, and they have to give the side effects. A lot of them say could cause death and all of these horrible things that they do.
It's such a joke, isn't it?
It's not even a joke. It's just
terrible. They try to say them really fast and long like that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And these beautiful people sitting in bathtubs or whatever they're doing, you know. And I'm wondering, first of all, do you get many patients that come to you and say, should I take zamenhoxazine or whatever the medicine is?
I used to get plenty. And it has to do with the nature of my practice now. So people will ask me that question, or what do you think about this? I heard about this, or should I take this? And what's the downside? What's the upside? So yeah, I get that question a lot. So I guess the thing I would say is that they never should have allowed advertising of prescription drugs. It was a really stupid idea, and it's led to a lot of cost inflation. And it hasn't really been, how should I put it? People come in with the attitude that if they don't get the expensive prescription drug, that they're getting second best.
And that's not going to fix them.
And that creates, as you say, a nocebo response, which is a problem. And actually, when you blind people to this, the threshold that the FDA gives for approving new drugs is, I think, kind of odd. It's equivalency. So my attitude is, we've got drugs for this. If yours isn't better, I mean demonstrably better, why are we approving it? It's going to be expensive for 20 years. It's going to add to the healthcare cost. If it's not better and you're going to be able to, it's just the same, just as good, you're going to have to get on there and spend a lot of advertising money to glam it up. And the doctors know that it's not better. But do you know that there's well, basically, doctors get kickbacks from pharma in the form of lecture gigs. So if you're a big writer of a certain drug, you will be offered a chance to give a lecture on it. And usually there's a...
Even in Hawaii or the Bahamas or something.
Well, no, I mean, even if it's just up in the next town, like we're gonna let you go to Los Gatos and give a lecture at a restaurant there where they don't know you. So we can pass you off as an expert and, you know, we'll pay you $1,000 and you drive over to Los Gatos and give a slideshow that's packaged. You don't have to do any work. In fact, they'd frown on you deviating from the script and you
and
get...
And that's okay.
Well, that's legal. I don't know if I'd say it's okay.
Bad choice of words, John. But
it's legal. But what it does is, so to say that doctors are neutral, there is an incentive to writing the more expensive drugs. And you can actually go, there's a national database, and you can see how much money your doctor got paid for lectureships. And for what drugs? So there's a sunshine law on that. So
well, that's a good
interesting
idea.
Thing
but
to look
who
up.
Would, who knew?
Yeah, I mean, that's, exactly.
That's really valuable information.
A couple of years ago, the Sentinel published an article about it and published the doctors locally and how much they'd been paid. They got access to the information and thought it was interesting. I remember seeing it and it was like, oh, well, that's interesting.
Well, now,
and it's not necessarily illegitimate if you have special expertise to go and give a lecture to other doctors and share it. But this is really kind. And by the way, the doctors attending the lecture also get a free dinner at a nice place. So,
but then they never bring any of us patients.
No, they never. They can't.
We never get that nice dinner.
We can't even bring our husbands or wives.
Is that right?
Right.
Only one nice dinner. That's all.
Only
you
one
get.
Nice dinner.
And while we're waiting for your call?
I'm going to talk about something that's right up your alley.
Oh, boy.
Actinic keratoses. You know, those
so much is.
Little rough red things that balding gentlemen get on the tops of their heads? Or
well, I wouldn't know. Oh, you mean me.
You're in the men's hair club there.
Yeah, I really am. But I've never had that, really.
Okay, but it's sun exposure related, and many people get them. They're like little crusty red spots, and they're typically treated by freezing because they are precancerous. Only about 1 out of 100 will turn into a squamous cell carcinoma, but that's still not odds that
you want.
So they're usually frozen, and if there are a lot of them, they're often treated with something called 5-FU. 5-fluorouracil, get your mind out of the gutter. I saw that look. But the 5-FU is painful when you treat people with it. You have to treat them for a long time, and they treat for maybe 10 or 14 days until they get a raw, weepy rash on their head or wherever you're treating, and then they stop and let it heal up. So what researchers have found is if you add a little bit of vitamin D cream, this is a vitamin D derivative, it's a prescription called calcipotriene, and it's used for psoriasis, where it's very effective. What if you take those two things and mix them together, just a little bit, just a dab of each one, 50-50, and you put it on the area twice a day for 4 days, you get almost complete resolution of the actinic keratoses, and you get no pain or irritation. So it's faster, it's better. Unfortunately, it's not cheaper. So the results were pretty impressive. The addition of the vitamin D product, the calcipotriene, made the response rate 86% compared to 26% with people who were just using the 5-FU alone. So there was not only was it less inflammatory and less irritating, but there was a much stronger benefit. So this is a really big deal if you're a dermatologist and if you're a patient. Well, the only problem for you is going to be the price of that calcipotriene, so you better hope that your Medicare Part D covers it.
I want, just for a moment, because I'm very interested in the acupuncture work you do.
Uh-huh.
Could you just give us a little pitch about what you do and how it works, and the short version, because we don't have enough time. But
well, the short version of acupuncture is it's like you're rebooting a computer. So the body wants to heal. and something's getting in the way. Acupuncture's therapeutics are aimed at figuring out what that is and breaking it up, so, breaking up the obstruction so that the healing can occur. You balance things, and it has profound effects on the nervous system. It has profound effects on blood flow. You can increase or reduce blood flow to a region, and it's very targeted with remarkably minimal to no side effects. So drugs go everywhere. Acupuncture goes where you send it. I think that's the biggest difference. It is a very profound way of treatment, and I tend to do that plus functional medicine first on most medical things that I encounter. And if it's inappropriate, we're going straight into Western medicine. If somebody's got a big infection, we're doing the antibiotics, but we also might be giving them a lot of probiotics and prebiotics so that they don't completely mess up their microbiome. And so we're thinking globally, maybe acting locally with the acupuncture, and then adding what we need from conventional medicine. I am joyous to be able to practice medicine this way over at 930 Mission. Look me up. The easiest way to find me is look me up, Dr. Don Motika, on the internet. And I'm not doing this show primarily for advertising, but thank you for giving me an opportunity to give myself a pitch.
And the website is
AskDrDon.com, and then click on the Connect to Dr. Don's Practice. My practice is at Optimage Health, but nobody remembers that name, so...
As always, it's been a real pleasure to have spend an hour and a half with you here at KZSC.
Thank you so very much, John. I have loved it. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDon.com for news about our future plans. Or follow my tweets at AskDrDon. For now, this is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Don is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.